Well, I had a different situation as well. I talk to clients and there's a line that you must cross. It's an invisible line. It's an invisible barrier that you must cross. And there's a point where you really, really, really want something. You're really committed. Everything. You're really going to do it. And then you cross the line where you're going to do it. Most people get close to that line, but few will really cross it. You see, I had to sell. My son didn't eat, so, yeah. So it's very different. The circumstances, you could say, were desperate, but they were beautiful because they set up that determination. I just didn't have a choice to think negatively. You know, if I didn't sell, we didn't eat. So.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
A very warm welcome. I'm Liz Gunn, and the wonderful Tim Lynch has asked me to do one program a month, which beams out from Green Planet FM on a Thursday morning at 8 o'clock. I jumped at the chance because Tim's vision for this program is really close to something in my own heart. What makes the world a more kind, a more aware, a more loving place? That really is where Tim comes from with all of his programs. And obviously, if you look back at Green Planet FM's archives, you'll see he's interviewed many interesting people who endorse that very vision. I have the same. What will make a difference in the world? And I believe firmly that communication, korero, talking to one another about vision and idea and action to make this world a kinder place, is the first step to change. Because we're really like little candles. If I light up as a candle, I can light the next flame. And the person that I have talking with me today, and the person who's going to do this program with me each month when we do fill in for Tim, is a very dear friend. I need to declare that first of all. And somebody who, in one of my darkest periods of my life, was that flame that said to me, "Don't you burn out. Don't you let your light go out. I believe in you and I will help you shine again." And so I owe this man a great debt of gratitude, and he's going to talk to us today about the three parts of his vision, about the work he's done, about his background. And I want to welcome him very warmly, Steve Papps.
Hi, Liz. Thank you for that introduction.
It's quite emotional. You could hear that in my voice because you have made a big difference in my life. It was a very dark period, and many women will know this. I had come out of a marriage. I suddenly found myself without enough financial resources, which is a very frightening place for any woman, with two children who needed a lot of support still, and a great deal of self-doubt, having been a full-time mother. And a dear friend of ours, Renee, from Renee's Kombucha, said, "You know, I think you should come and meet this guy who's meeting people once a week and doing free work, just helping people find what their purpose is. And his name's Steve Papps. Come and just have a chat." So we met in Wise Cicada in the little cafe there. And I'll never forget the sense, Steve, your heart space was wide open to help human beings. Tell us what took you there. What took you to that moment when I met you? It was a long, circuitous path, wasn't it, from your childhood? Perhaps begin as a little boy.
Sure. So starting off when I was a young lad, it was an interesting time growing up in South Auckland, with a mum who was an alcoholic. When I was born, my mum was 40, my dad was 50. So they were quite old as well. I spent some time in different foster homes. And then when I was 16, I had my first child, 16, 17. And by the time I was 19, I had three children. So it was a very interesting childhood, and they got cut short pretty quickly around about 16, 17.
When you had to grow up, you had to become suddenly a person functioning in the adult world.
That was really interesting, yeah, absolutely. I had to grow up real quick.
Before we skip over it, though, you once said to me that childhood made Once Were Warriors, when you saw the film, look like a holiday camp for you. There was violence, wasn't there?
It was a daily violence, yeah. Daily, maybe not daily, but at least every second day there was violence. There's police around at our place all the time. So that was common. And at our school, there were poor kids, and then there was us. So our goal was just to be a poor kid. we had it rough. But we didn't know, like at the time, that was just how we grew up. So if you look at it back now, I think, oh, that was really hard. But at the time, it was just me and my brother. And actually, when we went into foster homes, they were lovely people. It was really nice at the foster homes we went to, so that was like a holiday camp for us.
What do you think you got from that, before we move to that fatherhood part of your life, looking back from this perspective, what did it give you, that almost resilience you're talking about, wasn't it? Was it a determination? What was that young Steve doing to survive all that?
For me, when I look back on it, it was more about I always felt a need to prove myself from that. So that's a good thing and a bad thing. And so I excelled at school and I excelled at sport because I needed to get an identity. So it was one of those things that you either became a victim of it or it became the source of your strength.
So it made your drive for excellence. It shaped that in that childhood, because you do have that, a drive excellent.
Yeah, and there was a few things. When I was young, I was brought up in a time where my dad is English. We never really talked. He never really hugged us. My mum always did. Like I said, I was when I was born, he was 50, so I don't ever remember him playing any sport with us. So when I was young, there's a few things that I determined I was going to do. I was going to always hug my children. Even as adults, we kiss and hug in public. And the other thing was I was going to become wealthy, and so my children didn't have to experience that. So there was just a few things that I knew was going to happen from the childhood.
Can you remember lying in bed as a little boy thinking those things? One day when? One day it will be different. Can you remember?
I can see it clearly now, yeah.
Describe that for someone who's going through that kind of childhood, who's thinking, wow, how did he do that?
I'll tell you a couple of funny stories. It's funny now, but I didn't realise that at the time. There was, it was about 10 years ago, my wife and a friend of mine were joking that I always go to bed and if I have a nap, I always have a pillow over my head. And they were just joking about it and going, why do you always have a pillow over your head? Look like you're suffocating yourself, sort of thing. It was just over my eyes. I'd always go to sleep with that. And they're joking about it. I said, I can tell you the story if you want. And they go, okay. And it changed the whole mood of the conversation. But I said, when I was young, there was always parties. There was always parties and there was always loud music. There was always police and often there was fights. So the only way I would go to sleep is with a pillow over my head and my ears. So I didn't hear that. When I was young, we didn't have, I always wear shorts. It's very common for me to wear shorts most of the time. I didn't get my first pair of long pants till I was a teenager. So
wow.
My wardrobe was like two pairs of shorts. But at the time it wasn't bad. That was just how we lived, you know.
And you would lie in bed under that pillow and you would dream of a different life.
Yeah, what I call now is visualizing. It wasn't a dream for me. It was, I would visualize myself. There was a comic back then and it was Richie Rich. And I would read that. And then, at first it was just a daydream, I pretended I was Richie Rich. And then, as I did it, what happened was, and this is one of the things to help you go to sleep, was I found that each night I would think about that over a period of about a month or two, all of a sudden, rather than taking 20 to 30 minutes to go to sleep, I'd go to sleep in about 10 seconds, which I do to this day. And that's just because I go into my visualization.
What about your Māori side, Steve? Because you also have that. But was that something that was nurtured in your childhood at all? Did you have a sense of the wider whānau?
No, absolutely not. So when my mum was brought up, it was totally frowned upon. They would get the strap at school when that was still, if they spoke Māori. My mum could speak fluent Māori, but she never spoke it to us. And the schools I went to never had any Māori classes, nothing. It was only when I got to high school that I was exposed to that. So I grew up not knowing virtually any Māori, no Māori songs, nothing.
And no Māori grandparents? Nothing?
No, well, my mum was the black sheep of the family, so...
Why was that?
Probably because of a few things that she did when she was younger. So she was a right rebel, yeah, a free spirit, but a right rebel as well.
Which
so.
Probably came through to you in a good way.
I hope so, I hope.
Your brother, how did he cope with the background? Was there a big difference between the two siblings and the way you coped with the stresses of this? Because you didn't seem to give in to depression, and many children would feel overwhelmed, depressed, hopeless in that sort of environment.
Well, we grew up, we had really good schooling. So we had the poorest of places, and we lived in Greenland. And then growing up, I went to Cornwall Park Primary, and then went into Remuera Intermediate. So we were very poor, but we just happened to be in this great neighbourhood. So going through those schools, then most of my friends went on to Auckland Boys Grammar. Our place got pulled down, so we got moved out South Auckland, and then I went to Penrose High School, which is now Wintry High School. So back then, that was quite a rough school. So that was a big eye-opener for me. It was a big change. So that, I think the education helped me stay centred, really centred, and the sport. But then once we got to high school, both me and my brother started to lose it a bit. So it was about 13 that we both got involved heavily in alcohol and drugs and nightclubbing. So we were clubbing when we were like 13.
Wow. That's such an important part, because when you first told me your story, I remember registering two things. Number one, the crucial, beautiful part of New Zealand that had state housing mixed in with so-called wealthy housing and schooling encompassing New Zealanders from all backgrounds, because everybody benefits.
Yes.
The ones from the wealthier backgrounds learn empathy and learn how other people live. The ones who are, well, this is the second part of it for me, the ones who are intensely bright but from a background that doesn't have any privilege, they can then go on and excel. Because, you know, one thing I've learned with you, Steve, is you learn so quickly and you've got such a brilliant brain.
Oh, thank you.
So that whole exposure was so crucial in those early years to a good quality school.
Oh, that was critical. In high school, when I did my what was called school cert back then in fifth form, I could have done that in form two.
Yes.
Because form three, four and five, I didn't really attend very much at all. Like, literally, it was not really there. So it was that schooling that got me through all the way.
And I'll tell a story a little bit later on about how Steve has written two books, and he's done it effortlessly in a way that I just could not have done. But he does them so quickly, and he takes in so much information, such a great mind. So let's move to when that mind suddenly had to focus on being a father, prematurely, really young, obviously not planned.
No. And that definitely wasn't planned, 16. So 17, there was a wake-up call. My girlfriend at the time got pregnant. And then by the time I was 17, my youngest son, my son was born, Steve Jr., so that wasn't too much of an imagination with that name. And then I had to grow up real quick. So my dad was living in a rest home. My mum we couldn't stay with, so at 17 I had to go find a full-time job and support my partner and my son.
And what's interesting about that, there was no thought in you to abandon the woman who was pregnant with your child. No thought at all.
No.
It was simply, I have to be a responsible male and do something about this.
And so that drove me, because at 17, it's just minimum wages. So even if I was to work 50, 60 hours, which was fine with me, no matter how many hours, I couldn't actually earn enough at 17 to support my young family without any other support, except I ran across a job that was about commission sales. So you can earn as much as you want. is what the guy told me. And I remember saying to him, oh, this is a bit risky. And he goes, well, just come out with me for a day and I'll show you what I can earn. And you can see if you can do it or not. And you can earn as much as you want. It doesn't matter how old you are. So I thought, oh, well, what can I lose, you know? So I went out for a day, and this is going back when I was 17. So that's going back 30 years now. And he took me out. He said, today I'm going to make $100 commission. So back then, that's like, gosh, that's like $600 or $700 in a day of actual profit for him. And I said, okay, well, let's see how that works. So we went throughout the whole day, and it was just going business to business, cold calling, selling stationery products, little knickknacks, calculators, stuff like that. And by the end of the day, he handed back the products to the company. He handed back their money, and then he had his money, and he counted it out in front of me. It was just over $100. And that was almost my previous job. That was nearly my whole week's wages. And he just showed me how to do it in a day.
And what was the impact? What happened inside that brilliant brain of yours, Steve?
Well, he asked me a question. I never forget it. He's a Māori gentleman too. And I was really naive, which was good for me. So he said, do you think you can do that? I go, yeah. And he goes, and he wouldn't let me talk to the other salespeople. That was really interesting. And he goes, just do exactly what I told you and come in tomorrow morning, we'll get you started. So I went in the next day, and when I came in, he kept me away from all the other salespeople. Then they had their little staff meeting, and then I went on my way. It was a very basic sales presentation, or sales pitch, sales presentation. So I went, and on my first day, I made a high amount of sales, which is really good. I just did everything he said. I didn't outthink it. I didn't think, oh, this is not working. He said, if you go door to door, I still remember it, you'll see about 320 people in a day. Out of those 320 people, 300 will say no. You have to be able to handle that. Can you handle that? And I said, yep, for the $100 a day, I can. And then he said, then you'll get 20 yeses as long as you keep a positive mental attitude. But those 20 yeses can come at the start of the day, so you have to be ready in first call. They could all come at the end of the day, or they could come throughout the day. But they will come. You just have to stay absolutely positive, and you can't give up. And that's what he showed me. So I did it, and I made some, it was like quite a, it was a bit of a record sale for a first day. And everybody was, all the other salespeople, we meet up every day, every morning and every night. And they were all excited about it. And then I found out during the week, by the end of the week, I got talking to some other salespeople, that what I did was quite a big deal. I just thought that's what just what that guy told me to do, you know? And then I found out about the other side, the negative attitude. So I found people complaining about, oh, we don't have good territories, or it's not good products, or the prices are too dear of the stuff that we're selling. Now, those things never entered my mind. Because the salesperson had taught me, shielded me from all of that until I could start selling. So I had a good start.
Did your mind start to wander into that negative territory? Because in essence, you're giving everybody in this small story a metaphor for how to live life. Incredibly powerful metaphor. But did the negative start to wander in? Because this is what happens in human existence.
Well, I had a different situation as well. My... I talk to clients, and there's a line that you must cross. It's an invisible line. It's an invisible barrier that you must cross. And there's a point where you really, really, really want something. You're really committed. Everything. You're really going to do it. And then you cross a line where you're going to do it. Most people get close to that line, but few will really cross it. You see, as I had to sell, my son didn't eat, so, yeah.
That's powerful. That's very powerful. Steve Jr., by the way, is just the most wonderful young man and an absolute blessing. You would never be a day in your life without him, would you?
No. So it's very different. The circumstances, you could say, were desperate, but they were beautiful because they set up their determination. I just didn't have a choice to think negatively. You know, if I didn't sell, we didn't eat. So
what happened in those years, Steve? You excelled?
Yeah, I did great. I became assistant manager by the time I was 18 of New Zealand. And we went around New Zealand opening up various branches. And I had a whole team of people underneath me. And after about 2-3 years, one day I just felt totally burnt out. I couldn't get up. And then the following week I resigned, and then I spent about a month not really doing anything. And then I started a different career in security.
We'll talk about that in a moment. I'm just going to welcome anybody who's just joined us. I'm talking to Steve Papps. And perhaps we'll cut in here and say you have three businesses, Steve, because I haven't actually introduced all three branches. And we're going to, I hope we're going to get to all three.
Sure.
But the conversation has taken the turn of Papps Consultancy, which, so just explain the three branches of what you're doing, because Tim's program is, in its essence, about the well-being of the environment, of human beings, and of the future for our mokopuna, for our grandchildren. And this is something that is very dear to all three businesses. So just give us a brief introduction to all the three branches that you've gone into.
So Papps Consultancy, all about helping people with their consciousness.
Which is what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, so a lot of people, they come because they have financial issues, or they might have some serious health issues or relationship issues. And it's everything looks like it's external, but in fact everything is internal reflection. So it's about understanding how the universe really operates. And then when we understand that, then we can see how that applies in our life.
Everything starts to shift, and this is why I came to talk to you in that cafe four and a half years ago. How do I understand the world? And you said to me, stop blaming the externals and start going inwards, and we'll develop more of this. So sure. What's the second branch of the Papps?
So that's
Papps Companies.
Yeah, Papps Nutrition. So Papps Nutrition, by applying the same principles that I started to understand in business and becoming successful in that, I applied it to my passion of bodybuilding. So when I got started into bodybuilding, my first comp I came last, which is fine because I dropped 26 kilograms of fat. I just wanted to get up on stage. But my second competition, I thought I came second or third. The judges deemed that I should have come last, so
that wouldn't have appealed to somebody like you, Steve. I don't think you like being
annoyed the hell out of me. And I even thought about quitting, but I knew I couldn't quit until I won. If I didn't like the sport, I'd quit after I won, and then I'm making a true decision. And then I got coaching, I started to go through the same process that I do with business. And so my next comp I won, and then I started to win everything. When I won my first comp, then I would visualize standing on stage representing New Zealand at the most prestigious amateur championship in the world, which is Mr. Universe. And a year later, I found myself on that stage. So,
that sounds so easy, but behind all of that was this incredible ability to discipline your mind, to discipline your body with the training, but thirdly, to look at what you were putting in that body as its fuel. And you learnt, in typical Steve fashion, you learnt everything about nutrition, didn't you? I mean, that's not an exaggeration.
Yeah, I became passionate. The only way I beat people was they're bigger than me. They had different forms of assistance. So I outsmarted them in nutrition. That was a game I played. And I understood how my mind worked. My body would end up reflecting the picture I hold in my mind, as it always does. And so I became fascinated with nutrition and how I started to feel and how much health and vitality. So I was never a morning person, but now I get up most mornings about 4:30, and I work normally about 12, 14-hour day. Over the course, and plus I do my workout, and I finish my day with the same high energy that I start, and it's because I understand how to eat, I understand how to drink, and I understand how to breathe and think as well. So those are the four components. So I started my nutrition business because I just saw how much it affected myself and how it affected other people, and I wanted to share that.
You start that 4:30 in the morning with cooking your daily meals, don't you? You have all your meals done, and we will get to that. But nutrition, I think many people underestimate the power of the chemicals in the brain that in effect come from what we put in our body as fuel. It breaks down and it affects our thinking, doesn't it? It breaks down inside the body.
It's becoming more and more prevalent, and I'm 47 now. When I was a young lad, we never saw what we're seeing now, the epidemic we're seeing now, the rise in diabetes, the fact that 9 people a week in New Zealand, 9 people lose a limb due to diabetes. They have to they cut off an arm or leg because diabetes, that is totally preventable. We have all sorts of diseases, we have all sorts of intolerances. Everybody seems to be gluten intolerant now. When, say, 6-7 years ago, as a nutritionist, I never even heard of the word. And so things are really changing. As a population, we're becoming sicker and sicker. So obviously something as a population we're doing wrong. And it's the way that we're shopping, the way that we're eating, and what we're putting into our bodies, absolutely.
And last week we had these terrible suicide statistics, the highest suicide numbers ever in the history of New Zealand. Mm. That has to be to do with the food, the quality of the food going through, into the bloodstream in effect, really, isn't it? It's broken down in the stomach. And it affects what's in our bloodstream. If you have a high sugar diet, it's going to really affect the way we think, the way our bodies function.
Yes, and we use the same principles to help people. So by adjusting their food, adjusting their nutrients, we help people through depression. We help people, something as helping increasing a person's amount of healthy fats in their diet. That's especially what we do with women. And during the time of the cycle, we increase the amount of healthy fats, and that balances out your hormones. So that changes your moods and your cravings as well. So cravings are a sure sign that you're nutrient deficient.
You can have lots of food going in, but the body's not getting the minerals and the vitamins it needs. So it will tell you, give me more food.
Most people are overfed and at the same time starving of nutrients.
That's an extraordinary idea. Just give us a little taster from this side of your life, this nutrition side, of some of the greatest successes you've had. You talked about diabetes, and indeed people are told you can never heal diabetes. We've got chronic diabetes filling our hospital beds. Mm. What have you seen, Steve?
Well, it's illegal to say that you cure diabetes, and the reason it's illegal is if something is said to be cured, it means it can never come back, according to the medical fraternity. So we're actually not allowed to say that, but I can give you a story about Colin. Colin approached us with diabetes. He had nearly died at three separate occasions on the in the hospital due to diabetes-related illness. If he didn't inject insulin into his body every day, like many diabetics, he would die. So type 2 diabetes is horrific. He was given a diet by the dietitian at the hospital. He was given jelly and bread at the hospital during one of his recoveries, he was telling me, which was just absolutely shocking.
And talk about his mental state, because I do know Colin, his mental and physical state when you met him, Steve.
Well, so he was addicted to drugs and alcohol, so he was quite heavy in that. He loved the weights. He loved the gym, and that's where I met him at the gym, and he came and asked for my help. We had a chat about his condition, and we talked about his medication. And I told him, always seek the advice of your doctor. But I believe in a very short period of time, by adjusting his diet, I told him that we'd be able to help him come off that medication and not be identified with the diabetes.
He was also
situation.
Quite depressed, wasn't he? He wasn't getting off the couch when he wasn't at the gym doing a bit of training.
He was very depressed. So how it all started, we started talking. We did a nutrition plan for him 8 weeks later. It was exactly 8 weeks because it was his birthday. So that's how we know. He had a appointment with the diabetes clinic with his doctor. And so it just happened to be on his birthday of all days, which was 8 weeks after we started. So 8 weeks after we started, he was off all of his medication. He's never gone back on the medication again. Now, this is an interesting point. The doctor said to him, whatever you're doing, just keep doing it.
Wow.
Now, that's the first part of the doctor's statement. Let me tell you the second part. The second part, he asked, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm at the gym, I'm training, and I'm doing this diet. And the doctor goes, oh, what are you eating? And he told him. By the end of it, the doctor said, I don't know if you should be eating that. So even though he no longer is requiring diabetic medication, even though the doctor a few minutes said, oh, whatever you're doing, keep doing that, the specific things that we had him on, which is some of the things the doctor didn't agree with, such as certain healthy fats that are absolutely required, they're called essential fatty acids, the doctor said, I don't think you should be on that. And so that was very amusing to Colin and quite baffling to myself.
Colin's a beautiful story as well, because of course once he got his self-esteem up and his depression left and he was feeling good in himself, massive changes happened in his life. He wasn't in a relationship when you first met him.
No, but this is interesting because this goes on to perhaps consultancy. So he started with nutrition and then we continued the relationship. He's a very close friend of mine now. And at the time, he wasn't earning much money because he's on ACC. He had an operation on his knee and that wasn't healing too well. So he was a mechanic but currently on ACC. He didn't have wasn't in a relationship, hadn't been in a relationship for a while. Overweight and drug dependent and diabetic. So it wasn't like the ideal catch. It wasn't Mr. Successful at that stage, but a beautiful guy, really beautiful guy.
Beautiful heart.
Yeah. So after he dropped from 124 kilograms to about 99 kilograms, and then we set some more goals as far as in his body was concerned. And I said to him, when was the last time you were under 100 kilograms when we first met? He said, about 10 years ago. So he was under 100 kilograms fairly quickly. And then I said to him, when was the last time you saw your six-pack? And he goes, well, maybe when I was a teenager and when I was born sort of thing. So he got down to about 82, 83 kilograms of the full six-pack. And at the time, I started sharing with him a few things to read and to understand and to also do some certain exercises. So he would walk down the beach between Takapuna and Melford. You know the walk?
Yes.
Yeah, and he would do that. And I told him, just have a look at those houses, and we'll have a little chat about it and tell you which is his favourite house. So the next time we met, he told me about it, and I remember the conversation really well. And I said to him, tell me the house that you really like, and he explained it to me, and I said, do you realise that people live there? He goes like, yeah. And I said, great, great. Now, they're just normal people. There's nothing special. He goes, got it. I said, they're not zebras who live there. They're not aliens. They're just normal people. And I said, what's the difference? This is my point. What's the difference between them and you? And it's not education. The reason they're in that position isn't education, experience, or network. Because I can tell you many, many people that have got worse education, worse network, and worse experience than you, but have gone on to do great success. So what is the difference? Because that should be the burning question in your mind. So we started him. I asked him about what he would love to have. He said he'd love to own his own house. And I said, what about relationship? He goes, oh, yeah, I'd love to have a special lady in my life. And I said, and travel, what about travel? He goes, oh, it's not even on the radar. All these things. I might as well told him to go and be an astronaut and live on Mars. So we talked a little bit more about that, but it would have only been about maybe 6 to 8 months later, he found himself in the company of this beautiful young woman who they just fell head over heels. And they've ended up getting married. It was a secret wedding. Nobody knew about it. So they got together. She got pregnant very quickly. So now he's a father. He just had his first Father's Day last week. And her parents do quite well for themselves. So he's going to be travelling probably once a year to France to stay with them. They've got properties in various places around the world. And they're keen to help support him to get started and for them to get their own place here as well. So he's gone from overweight, depressed, drug addict, nearly dying of diabetes, no job, to all of that totally changing, starting with the nutrition and then moving into just understanding about his consciousness.
And for people listening, I remember, Colin, he was disciplined as well. There was a shift that happened in him, Steve, where I would see him in that gym every time I went there. He, you know, it's not without a great commitment on his part, but it wasn't efforting. It felt as if some shift had happened where he was so joyous. Yes. in making this change of energy. And you had a huge part to play in that.
Yeah.
But he also had a huge part, to his credit.
Yeah.
You are listening to Liz Gunn interview Steve Papps of PappsNutrition.com. P-A-P-P-S Nutrition.com.
Discipline gets you started. It's just like turning the key in the ignition. It's a very, very short part that requires discipline. What is required is awareness. And we can then go on and have a little chat about the difference, but it's a huge difference. So discipline gets you started, gets the momentum, but awareness will keep the change.
I would like to keep chatting. I love the way this is evolving. So when we try to separate the nutrition company, we immediately get back to the whole idea of PAPS consultancy, which is talking about essentially the awareness, or you could call it the vibration, the energy that we put out into the world. Mm. The stories overlap both.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about that awareness, because that people listening will think, well, what does that mean? Some people. What? Explain it a bit more clearly.
Okay. So
even with reference to Colin, how you helped him, you talked about those people in the houses between Takapuna and Milford. So let's talk about how that accessed.
Maybe I'll tell you another story and then we can go into that. I went yesterday to a friend, Renee. That's who introduced us together, right? I went to his farm. So when I met Renee, there was a marketing seminar. That's how we met. And he approached me, he wanted to know more, and we became friends. And then he wanted to hire me to help him to achieve his goals. Now, he knew all about the positive goal setting, positive mindset, and he knew quite a bit about the law of attraction and stuff like that. But he definitely wasn't showing up in his results. So.
And for many people, that happens. Many people read these books that have all the wonderful principles, but it doesn't quite show up in their own lives.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly. So Renee, at the time, I asked him what's his goal, and he wanted to be a full-time chef. And so a full-time raw food chef. So this going back a few years when nobody had really heard of raw food in New Zealand. He'd come from Germany. He'd won an international competition. He'd done really well with his overseas as far as in getting some recognition. Came to New Zealand trying to break into the industry. And this
was in the early days when Kiwis were still coming to learn about raw food. So he was quite advanced. Yes.
Yeah, raw foods, even organic foods. So I asked him what was he doing. And he said he's just, while he's working on how to get into becoming a full-time raw food chef, he's just doing some waitering part-time. And and I said, oh, how long have you been being a waiter? And he goes, oh, 2 years. Yeah, and that's what I laughed, and I said, Renee, you're a waiter. That's what you're doing, mate. And that was a little bit shocking for him to face the truth. Mm. He's always getting around to it, but actually really doing nothing.
And I'm not laughing at Renee. I'm sort of laughing at myself, because we've all done this. I'll one day do this dream, but in the meantime, I'll do the absolute opposite of what I'm really dreaming about. Exactly. I'm laughing at myself.
Yeah, me too.
We all do it.
And it's a false sense of getting myself organized or prepared.
Yes.
It's like people, next week, I'm going to join the gym.
Yeah.
You can join the gym today. It's just a phone call, you know. And as far as I can't join the gym, I don't have money, you can walk outside. So nothing stops us. Absolutely nothing.
Except our thinking.
Oh, absolutely. So with Renee, he went on, we did a little, some exercises. And the exercises are very confronting. So what ended up happening with Ray, he left his job, ended up changing his whole awareness, his whole understanding of how the energy of how the universe operates. What progressed was he got a job at one of these new worlds, and it was a progressive new world as well, as far as in they had a deli that wanted a lot of organic food. So he was actually, he became a raw food chef. He went on to do consulting and then running classes for other chefs, teaching them how to become a raw food chef and to do workshops for people. And he became quite popular with that. And he's making a living out of that. And then he...
And this was with you in the background saying, take the step, do the action.
Yes, yes. And then one of the products he really liked was kombucha. And so now you'll find Renee's kombucha throughout many outlets right throughout New Zealand. So Renee came from barely able to support himself with his part-time waiter work to now being successful. Him and his wife, they've got a beautiful farm up north that I visited yesterday, lovely farm, about 20 hectares. They've got goats, cows. They're living their exact dream, the dream that he wanted years ago.
But there was a crucial step, Steve. There was a point where he came to you and said, I want this kombucha business. And what did you say about selling everything, Renee? Tell us that.
So this is just to a side note. This is not what I get every person to do, but this is what you could say was channeled at the time through myself. When this was at the very beginning of our conversation, by the way, not just with the kombucha business. This is when he first started, and I could see his fear. His fear was letting go of being a waiter, the security of his. The illusion of security of being a waiter to going after his dream, or the maybe the more accurate way of saying it, tuning into a frequency where his dream already exists. So I could see that he was very scared. That's why he's holding on to being a waiter. And so I said to him, this is your first step is go resign from there. And also, because you're adverse to risk, how much money do you have in savings? And he told me, and it wasn't any great amount. And I said, also, what are the assets you really love? He goes, oh, I like my boat and his motorbike. He didn't have a car at the time; it was a boat and motorbike. I said, get your savings, sell your bike, sell your kayak, and tell me how much that is, and then within a week, give all that money to charity, and then you'll be free of it. Because it's your slave. That's the issue right now.
For someone who is averse to risk-taking, who is wanting to stay in a comfort zone, what a brilliant way to challenge them out. What a brilliant way.
Yeah, it's what was channeled through that meeting for him. And so Renee did it. I think the surprising thing to Renee is he didn't do it straight away. He gave me a call a little bit later and said, I'm selling the stuff. I said, oh, that's good, Renee. And then about a week later, he said, I've done it and I've given it away to charity. Like, he was really happy to tell me. And I told him at the time, I said, it doesn't impress me. That was for you. That's got nothing to do with me. So don't think telling me that you didn't give me any money, so, you know, it doesn't make me overly impressed. That was just what you had to do for yourself. So you're not reporting to me as such. I'm not your guru. It wasn't that. This is from infinite intelligence, from you, through you.
So for somebody feeling totally confused right now, what happens inside a brain when you, a mind that's saying, cling on, play it safe, don't take risks, don't you dare step over the cliff? What happens when a human being can take that leap off the cliff? They fall or they fly?
Well, that's exactly it. You don't know until you do it. And so... Every successful person, I promise you, every successful person, you ask them in whatever field they're successful at, they'll tell you about the amount of failures they had. It's all part of the process going forward. So if it's like me saying to you, let's say I come from overseas, I'm a young lad and I just came from overseas and I said to you, look, I see all these people playing rugby. I think it's a great game. And I see these All Blacks. They're all famous. Man, I want to be an All Black. So can you teach me how to play rugby? But this is the one thing. I want to play rugby but never get tackled. So can you teach me how to do that? Because I hear you're a good coach. Now, that's just a silly story, right? You can't play rugby without getting tackled. You can't succeed without failures. And they're not failures. They're just part of the deal. The part of the learning, the part of the refining of your consciousness. So the greatest rugby players have been tackled the most. The greatest business people have failed the most in business. So if you're unwilling to get tackled, you can't play rugby. If you're unwilling to lose money in business, you can't play business. If you're unwilling to get hurt in love, then you can't play love. So it's all the same deal.
So it's that willingness to embrace the thing you fear. And that somehow changes this level of energy you operate at, or the vibration that you operate at in the world, when you're willing to go right into the fear, face it full on.
Well, when you're aware, you're not even in fear. It's but there's fear because of the energy that you're in at that time. So, you know, everything, if we go a little bit deeper, everything is energy. We learned that at high school. Now, I didn't pay that much attention to high school, so I remember it from intermediate, but everything is just energy vibrating. So you got atoms, and we broke them down, protons, neutrons, electrons, we break that down. And then when you break it down to its most finest form, just energy vibrating. It's actually flashing in and out of existence. And we're all this energy, that is us in our essence. There is no second energy outside of the one energy. It's just one energy expressing itself in many forms. And you can talk about it from a scientific point of view. You can talk it from a religious point of view. There's one God expressing itself as all forms. But there's actually only one energy. And all energy, the nature of energy is it just vibrates on different frequencies. And so whatever vibration, whatever frequency we're vibrating at when it comes to money, is the frequency that we're on. It's got nothing to do with how smart we are. It's got nothing to do with how many hours we work. It's got nothing to do with the product, the competition. It's got nothing. Like virtually 99.999% of it is solely vibration.
So if I have a vibration of fear on money, I won't have enough. That thought pattern, it's almost reflected back to me. It's almost like there's like a mirror.
Yeah, it's not almost. It's exact. It's absolutely exact. So that when you stand in front of a mirror, it doesn't almost reflect back your reflection. It has no choice of its own. It has no volition of its own. It simply reflects. And it doesn't reflect what we say. It reflects the energy we're vibrating at. And if you want to know what energy you're vibrating at in a specific subject, you just have to ask yourself this question: how do I truly feel about this subject for today? So how do I feel about money today? So if I feel, how I normally feel, then that's the normal money that you'll be expecting. And you may want a lot of money, but when I started going into business and I went through my first round of making a fortune and made a few million dollars, and I had people around me who were multimillionaires as well, it's really interesting. It was nothing like the books I read. There were some of those people who were extremely wealthy, who were really nice people. You wouldn't even know they had a lot of money. And very beautiful, humble souls. And they're right little rascals, you know. They're just like mischievous devils. There's liars. There's people. I got told in all these self-help books that you have to be organized. And you should be organized. But I knew multimillionaires who were totally disorganized, totally dysfunctional. And so all the things that I learned wasn't quite what I was seeing in the real world. But when it came to money, what I found out is they all did have one thing in common. Every wealthy person had one thing in common. And that one thing was they truly expected to be wealthy. They could be honest, they could be dishonest, they could be nice, they could be not so nice. But that's the one thing. That's the same when it comes to, say, relationships. It's exactly the same. We all know that one lady who's like, she's dating the same guy. It's a different guy every few months, but it's the same guy with a different name.
Yes.
And it's going to be the same outcome. Yes. And you can see it all the time. And that's why you get a woman, and this is a hard pill to swallow, who they might have grown up in a where their mum was abused. Now, that nobody goes, I want to be abused. Nobody does that. But they have been set to that vibration. They're accustomed to that frequency. And so quite often they grow up, and because they're set at that frequency, they'll tune into an abuser, as the abuser will tune into a victim. And so what happens is if that person abuses them and they leave, the next person will tend to be the same. Even if they act like they're not, they tend to be. It's not until that person truly changes their energy. And it's not their conscious thoughts. It's not going, I don't want to be abused. Of course they don't. It's like people who are lacking money, they're not saying, I want to be poor. Of course they don't. But it's an awareness. It's awareness of how your energy is vibrating at, and awareness of what's causing that, and then how to change that.
It's like that thing on the computers when you defrag your computer, you get rid of this mysterious stuff underlying the computer programming that's slowing it down. It is so subconscious in many people. Give me an example of what you would say to that woman, because there are millions of that woman out there who are going, I don't want the same kind of man, but I keep attracting it. Mm. Where would you begin with that, Steve?
Everything in your external world is a reflection of your internal world. The first thing to do is to, it's like food. The first thing before you start introducing good food is stop all the bad food. The first thing to stop is to stop the recording in your mind that everything that's happening outside of you, this relationship, actually has anything to do with the person that you have a relationship with.
That's so challenging. So stop the blame game, stop the history, stop the story of what this person did or that person did.
The person can only stay in your life by giving it, by you giving it attention. That's the only way that person and that particular behaviour can stay.
So if we're looking at it as a hierarchy of vibrations, the more you tell the story of your suffering, the more you're taking your own vibrational energy down, and therefore you attract more from that same low frequency.
Absolutely. So when you tune into Planet FM, you'll get Planet FM. You won't get my FM, you won't get hierarchy. You can ring up and ask for some rock music, but it's not going to happen, right? And you can blame the radio. You can change the, maybe turn up the volume, but nothing will change until you become aware. It's not discipline. Until you become aware, there's actually a channel that you can tune. That's the only thing that needs to change. And when you tune that and you tune into hierarchy, you'll get what's expected from hierarchy.
But I can hear those women going, it's all very well to say that, but I've suffered and I have to be careful that I don't go into that again. How do I change that frequency? It won't even feel real to me to change that frequency. Do you fake it till you make it? Do you say, I'm going to picture a man who has a different kind of vibration, a best friend, a beautiful being? You really focus on that?
No, it comes back down to the same awareness. It's like saying, when I'm listening to hierarchy, can I just pretend it's Planet FM? No. It's just called denial.
And, damn. And so take me there. So where do you take those women?
The subject is the same subject for all subjects. It's always vibration and frequency. What you're looking at is an expression of your energy. You're not looking at reality. Reality is happening inside of you. And everything we see only exists because of our attention to it. So every radio station exists in the same point. So if I had a radio and I was holding it right here, I can tune into many different radio stations and they all exist in the same point. But the only one I can listen to is the one I'm tuned into. So it's some fundamental understandings. So everybody's trying to change, first of all, they're trying to change their external world. But that external world is an illusion. I'm not talking about a new age illusion. I'm talking it's an actual physical illusion. Reality happens on the inside. The story we're playing out on the inside, we'll see hardened, our energy hardened into physical form and what we call reality. That to me is not reality. That's my whole point. And so you don't have to create something. It actually already exists. All frequencies actually already exist right now. It is quite a bit of a mind jump. But when you get it, you will laugh. You'll have what I call the Buddha laugh, that it can't be that simple. It actually is. The mirror, whatever you hold in front of the mirror, let's come to money. Whether I hold $10, $1,000, $100,000, the mirror doesn't say when I put $100,000 in front of it, oh, that's a bit hard. Plus, you've never put this amount of money in front of me for the last 20 years. So this is going to take a little while for me to reflect it. It reflects it instantly and effortlessly. Now, we get frustration. So if I was to talk to that woman about frustration in her relationship, she also reflects and attracts frustration easily and effortlessly. Her partner gives it to her easily and effortlessly. But it starts from within.
So everybody's manifesting all the time anyway. It's just a lot of people are manifesting what they don't want.
We have no idea how powerful we are as individuals. So people have no idea what's going on in their body, their universe. In your body, there's 37.2 trillion cells. 37.2 trillion, and they're all reacting with each other. Now, just to give you some thoughts about this, with the 37.2 trillion cells, if I was just to count that number, it'd take me over 1 million years. So just to count that number. Now, these cells are having hundreds, if not thousands, of reactions each individually with every other cell that is doing the same. But let's say they're only having one reaction with each other. So let's say there's 37.2 trillion reactions every second. Now, you know me, I don't multitask. I probably like doing two things at once. I really do. I just can't do it. But to do 37.2 trillion different tasks every second. That is an incredible intelligence that's flowing through us, doing that even while I'm asleep, even while I'm in the toilet. All of this is going on. And I can see it. I wake up and somebody turns on the lights called the sun. Somebody wakes up all the flowers. There's life flowing effortlessly. And all of this life is happening in cycles. There's a rhythm. There's a laws that operate this universe. But we fall into thinking this is my world and this is how the world is. It's actually pretty much, you'll be accurate if you think it's virtually the opposite. The influence you have is absolutely tremendous, and these laws are exact. The laws of the universe are absolutely exact, and you can apply them in each area of your life. You can have a totally different life, but if you don't even understand that or don't think it's possible, then it won't even open up for you.
So I want to take it back, because we are going to have to end, but we will do this again next month, Steve. I want to take it back to that little boy with the pillow over his face who daydreamed. It's almost that thing we all did as children, which was effortlessly daydream about what we were going to do one day.
Well, that's right. And everything you see, just so you know, like Einstein said, that imagination, that is your image in action. That's what the word literally means. Your imagination, what people call daydreaming, is your image in action, or your image becoming form, is more powerful and more important than knowledge. Every building you see, every business you see, every car, every ship, the clothes you wore, started with one person daydreaming, thinking, I'm going to do that.
Before it became solid form, before it became evident in the world. Mm. Steve, we're going to have to resume your life story very briefly, though, to finish off. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. A third company is to do with water, and we will get to that story of water and the book you've written about water in a future episode. But just very briefly, you did become a millionaire, and you lost your money.
Mm.
You lost it through...
I lost it through the same principles how I got it. So in 2005, I made my first million, several million more. And I daydreamed about a Ferrari and a mansion and all the trappings of success and a Hummer. And I had all of that. And then it was about a year or 2 years into it that I was doing extremely well. I thought to myself, now, just don't mess this up, Steve. I remember the words very, very, very clearly. And so it's like holding a coffee or a wine and you've got a nice shirt on and going, don't drop this, just don't drop it, just make it back to my chair and don't drop it. You're going to get knocked. And so by misapplying those principles, I tuned into reality where people took advantage of me. I made some wrong decisions. I ended up bankrupt. And that spun me out into depression, which is a really important part of my growth.
And we'll talk about that in another time. For both of us, depression has been a crucial part of shaping who we are. Thank you so much, Steve Papps. Wonderful to talk to you, and we'll be doing this more together in the future and interviewing other people.
Thanks, Liz.
What a good interview. Isn't he marvellous?
That was Liz Gunn interviewing Steve Papps of PappsNutrition.com. PappsNutrition.com. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say Kia Kaha and Haere Uraa.